Welcome back, everyone. I'm Shannon Larratt, and you're listening to the 16th broadcast of BME Radio. Today's show may be a little bit more discoordinated than usual, because we're doing this interview across time zones, so it's real late here, and I've got a coffee in one hand and a beer in the other hand, so probably not a healthy thing. Anyway, the person we're speaking with today has probably generated more online hate mail than any other body modification artist, but at the same time, almost everyone that's had work done by him swears by him and never goes to a mainstream piercer again. His techniques involve almost exclusively large gauges, and the majority of his procedures use a scalpel far more than a needle. His aftercare is radically different than what you'd be told by either your piercer or your doctor, and to top it all off, his opinions are exclusionary, and if you don't do it his way, you're probably not doing it right. Todd Bertrand, thanks for talking to us today.
That was quite an intro, Shannon. I was trying not to giggle on the other end. Boy, I hadn't quite the idea I had that kind of reputation there.
Well, if you have anything, it's a reputation. Todd, the first thing I want to ask you about is piercing technique. Why go big?
Well, right size is not necessarily big. It's the right size for the right body part. When you're dealing in below the neck areas, you're generally dealing in an area that moves more, such as the navel, in an area that swells and expands and contracts considerably with heat, cold, and sexual arousal, such as your nipples and your genital region. When you're dealing in a thin gauge, such as the 14 gauge, you put it in your earlobe or your eyebrow, well, hey, that's just fine, but these areas do not do that. When you have a thin gauge in these areas, it tends to be like a dull knife in the skin and continually cut the skin area, building up massive scar tissue, which becomes hardened, and then continually cuts over time and causes loss of sensation, migration, rejection, all kinds of serious problems, such as a permanent pathway for all types of infectious diseases to get into the body always. It's really, really bad for you to start with the wrong thing in the wrong area. The difference here of opinion is if you have a thin gauge and you heal in a inappropriate manner, most people consider that if they have a ring in their thing, it's a good piercing. And that is not my opinion. A ring in your thing means that you have a ring in your thing, and that's it. It doesn't make it good. It doesn't make it bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be done generally better than putting, shall we say, a 14 gauge in your nipple, for example. Much better, with much better results. Doesn't mean the 14 gauge is wrong. It means that you, why go buy a Model T when you can go buy a Ferrari? You know, why do that?
Well, I think some people would say that they like the look of the 14 gauge.
Sure. But some people do it just for looks.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Most of these people who do it for looks have absolutely no concept of how good it can feel with the proper gauge and healing technique. That is saying, well, gee, I really want to make love to my boyfriend, but is it supposed to feel good?
Mm-hmm.
What's an orgasm? And there's people out there like that. I mean, really, really bad. I did the Inkslinger's Ball here recently last year, and these girls wanted to show me what kind of genital piercings could be done. And this girl was 30-some years old, had kids, and had no concept what a hood was or what interlabia was. And Ellen Thompson was with me, and she saw, wait a minute here. You're like 30-something years old, and you got children, and you don't even know what labia is? You've never heard this word. She was just aghast at this girl, and she had no concept.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you're dealing in the same thing. If someone has the education, it takes the time to educate someone about their body and what can be done and why, and what the differences are, they won't get a 14 gauge in their nipple. The problem is it's going to take 2 or 3 hours to sit there and educate the person what and why, what's going on, and you're dealing in a profit ratio of 30%+ for a 14 gauge ring in your nipple, as opposed to maybe doubling or tripling your money on a 6 gauge ring, if you invest thousands of dollars to have them done properly, which most manufacturers don't make 6 gauge correctly.
Mm-hmm.
When Silver Ranker was in business, literally I'd spend $3,000 to $10,000 in order, okay? And I don't have the volume that most of these people do. That's a lot of money, okay? And I'd invest that to have my stuff done right, and I would still only get my price down to 6 at 6 gauge to $12 a ring, whereas you can buy a 14 gauge for a buck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think part of the other thing is, and this is even more the case in Europe, that there's this sort of denial that even genital piercing is a sexual thing. I think there are a lot of piercers who don't want to admit, they want you to believe that it's just decoration.
Last I heard, in England, it's illegal to get pierced for a sexual reason. You can pierce anything.
It certainly was.
It's illegal or something.
It may not be now, but it certainly was at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And that point where, you know, those were the rules, that's when piercing sort of defined itself.
Right.
Anyway, I was going to ask you more about this later, but since we've moved into it now, I want to talk a bit about the overlap between piercing and sexuality. That's actually how you learned how to pierce.
Yes. When I saw my first piercing, which if anybody's read my interview from Gauntlet years ago, it was a tremendous emotional, mental, sexual response. And this was, I mean, I was 18 years old, and 18 years old, anything new and wild and wow, I mean, your hormones are in full swing, but at the time, you just didn't see this. And this girl was very beautiful, and she had her nose pierced of all things. And it didn't even, hadn't occurred to me that you could pierce something besides your ear, which was common if you were a girl at the time, but I mean, you didn't see anything else. And I was right here in LA, and I was just like, oh my God, this is just incredible. I must have followed around the store with my mouth hanging open. It struck me that tremendous. And when I finally went out and got pierced, which took me, there were several things that took me so long. One, the relationship I was in for 6 years ago was just, couldn't deal with it. But to society at the time, if you were male and you had a piercing, you were considered gay. And there's a historical reason for this. Jim Ward, the owner of the Gauntlet, was gay, a leather gay, and he was very, very heterophobic and literally kept piercings in the closet for many years because of that, because he didn't want the straight people to get pierced. He didn't like them at all. And when he did his first clit piercing, the girl literally had to sit there and show him what a clitoris was. He had no concept at all of what a clitoris was. And an interesting aside to Gauntlet, and I want to bring this up right now. My techniques, which would make me so controversial, are anything but Gauntlet techniques, and everybody is following literally what Gauntlet has developed. Jim Ward was a good businessman. He was the biggest and the best. He was backed by a millionaire, Doug Malloy, which is why he succeeded when everybody else at the time failed, because there were other small people around, but they didn't have the money. They didn't have the backing.
Well, I think I want to interject that, too. And I think a lot of people forget that, you know, Gauntlet was the first business, and you know, there's this mythology that at the time there were, you know, seven people in North America involved in piercing, but that's a load of crap, right?
Gauntlet was the only store exclusively devoted to piercings. I mean, there's the odd eargun mall or tattooist doing an eargun piercing in a store.
What I'm saying is back then, even though there weren't, you know, piercing studios on every corner like there are now, mm-hmm. there were still tens of thousands of people practicing piercing in their homes.
Yeah, there was people piercings, you know, in their homes.
And I think that it didn't have the tribal sort of overtures that a lot of it has now or any of that. It was all in the sexual arena.
It was entirely piercing. Even Gauntlet came from a sexual arena. Mm-hmm. It was all leather gay. It was all wild, intense sex.
Mm-hmm. But
piercings came from an entirely sexual arena. It hasn't gone to the what's not sexual until recently, when people consider, you know, all the young teeny boppers who are afraid to admit that, gee, I get my tongue pierced because I might give my boyfriend head tonight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're too afraid to admit that, gee, I want to get fucked.
And it's not just
young kids. They're young, immature young kids who do it because they saw their buddy do it.
You know, and it's not even just weird sex, too. I mean, I think piercing adds to even just vanilla sex.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It has nothing to do with any type of specific sex, but it did come from a very heavy SM environment, which was Gauntlet's roots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Gauntlet was created to cater to the leather gay SM environment. This was the entire purpose of Gauntlet
yeah.
in its inception.
Anyway, I want to talk a bit more about this. We're going to take a quick music break. This is my doctor just told me I'm not allowed to eat any more chocolate. So this is some live Shonen Knife, who does like chocolate.
Thank you very much. Nikki's song is my favorite food song. I want to eat chocobars. I like chocobars.
Todd, we were talking on the break about how even just facial piercing is a kind of sexual behavior.
It is, totally.
How's that?
Whenever you change your body whatsoever, or lack of change, having dreadlocks, for example, I don't wash my hair and I twist it round and round and round and it's dirty and smelly. Whatever you do, I don't care what it is, you wear a suit, you wear nothing, you paint your body, you cut your hair, you shave your head, anything you do to it to change its look will cause yourself and your personality to be perceived differently by those around you, mm-hmm. which is causing a sexual attraction with those around you within a certain parameter based upon your perception of yourself, of those who you want to attract.
Mm-hmm.
Piercing does this even more so than anything else you can do, because it's a statement, it's a poke in the eye, look at me, look at my shiny thing in my body, and draws attention to that. And how anybody could say that piercing is a non-sexual thing is literally wearing blinders about what sexuality is all about and what people do. Why does a girl wear a miniskirt? Why does she wear makeup? Why does she wear perfume? Why does she spend thousands of dollars on nice clothes? Because she thinks she's ugly? Because she doesn't want somebody to come up and ask her out? Because she doesn't want to feel good about herself? Or because she's doing it because she feels good about her sexuality and wants to be sexual? You have two choices here.
No,
A or B.
Anyway, we were talking about how you actually learned to pierce, and a lot of it was a period in your life where you were, I guess, promiscuous, and you know, you experiment with piercing with your girlfriends, and through that you learned what piercings worked sexually, how they worked, and all of that.
Through that, I learned size, gauge, placement, diameter. I came up with a lot of the theories that I use today. It took a lot of time to develop those theories because of lack of tools, because of lack of proper jewelry and so forth. I literally had to front the money for a company to start so that I could get the jewelry an A gauge made in half inch diameter. It didn't exist at the time unless you wanted to spend $100 a ring,
mm-hmm.
which obviously I couldn't afford that. It was too much.
Mm-hmm.
back... For a younger person in their 20s or their teens, it's really a myth of the sexual revolution and free love of the hippie days and all this sort of thing. But the reality is, until roughly 1990, if you were in the heterosexual crowd in a big city and you went out to a club and you wanted to go home and sleep with someone, you literally went home and you met someone and you fucked them. It was that simple. It was that easy. You met someone on a street corner. They stuck their thumb out. And within an hour, you were in bed. And this was normal. This is what everybody did. No condom, no protection, no worry about AIDS, no worry about disease. And I did it for years. I never got anything. And at the time, I was going out to clubs in Hollywood. And if I wanted a girl to have a piercing, well, guess who got to pierce her? They didn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see people in Hollywood with pierced anything. I mean, I was in the thick of the club scene in Hollywood. And I had little 14-gauge nipple rings, and I had crowds around me because I had my nipples pierced. You didn't see it. They were like, oh, my God, look at that guy. And today, this is common, but it wasn't then. But today, on the other side of the coin is, you don't go out and just meet someone and hop in bed in an hour. That's uncommon. It's really rare.
Mm-hmm.
Things have changed. Society has changed. But that's literally what I do. I'd go out, and I'd go to clubs, and I'd meet a girl, and I'd bring her home, and shave her pussy and pierce her nipples, and if I liked her and she hung out, we went out again, and I'd pierce her pussy, and I liked her and hung out again, and I'd pierce a few other things. But I kept in touch with the vast majority of these girls, and so it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot, because when you're dealing in, let's say I was in a massive volume store and I was doing 20,000-30,000 piercings a year. Well, first off, I wouldn't have a chance to talk to these people. I'd just poke a hole and send them on their way, and here's your little paragraph of instructions.
And more importantly, you wouldn't have a chance to fuck them afterwards.
Well, regardless whether you fuck them or not, you don't have the opportunity to actually sit down and in a intimate environment see what's really happening with their body and what's working.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless whether you actually stuck something inside them, you got to see...
Well, obviously, that's what I mean. You got to see how it works.
Exactly. Exactly. I got to see what is working and why. What is working on my body getting them off? Why is it working? What's working on their body and all their different shapes and sizes and why?
Mm-hmm.
In this very, very intense sexual arena.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me an insight that I don't know if anybody else has at all.
You know, I think you're probably right. the few promiscuous piercers I can think of are gay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole different set of issues, I'm sure.
Yes, it's a whole different set of issues. And while I'm not gay, I've still had plenty of anal sex, which works very similar. So I have insights into all types of sexuality, from the straight to the bisexual to the gay set, because of the amount of women I've been with and the amount of different types of sex I've had. So,
mm-hmm. Well, let me ask: now you're doing this also as a business a bit. Is it sometimes difficult to have, do the lines blur between client and girlfriend, or
when you have enough sexual experience?
Mm-hmm.
You can tell if someone wants to be approached or not. Okay, when you're a young male and you're 18 or 20 years old, you don't know whether this girl wants you to ask her out. So what do is you ask them all out, mm-hmm. or you don't get laid. Okay, and I get a lot of flack for this because I go into BME chat and I try to explain to people. It's like, hey, this is like going into a bar. I'm off here. I'm not working, and I might flirt with every girl in there,
mm-hmm.
but I'm flirting. This isn't real. This is cyber here. One. This is what we're doing. We're in here to chat, flirt, have a good time. It's not like they're in front of me and their clothes are off. One.
Mm-hmm.
And two, in a real live situation, you can look at someone if you have enough sexual experience and you can tell right away whether they want to fuck you or not. And you have the option to pick up on that and decide whether you want them or not. So if you approach someone with the sexual experience I have, you already know whether they want you to.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't...
Yeah.
Have that problem of, gee, should I ask this girl out and what's she going to say?
Mm-hmm.
Ever.
I mean, I think you know that one of the things that people accuse you of is sort of, mm-hmm. you know, being on the prowl for, you know, young girls to, you know, to modify in the chat rooms and things like that. How would you respond to people saying that?
Well, exactly what I was saying. It's not, I'm off. They're not walking into my house. They're not walking into my studio. Okay. I'm off.
Mm-hmm.
This is my off time. I'm out having fun. What, just because I'm a piercer, if I go to a club, okay, regardless of the fact I'm a piercer or not, if I'm going out to a club to meet girls and get laid, what am I going to do? I'm going to flirt with them. I'm hopefully going to talk about my piercings, whether they want some, because if they don't want any, why do I want to take them home?
Yeah.
Okay? If they're not into piercings, I don't even want to know their name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I just crossed them out. If they can't talk about my piercings, I can't ask them about theirs, they're done. Off to the next one. But that's in a club social environment where you're going to go out and try to get laid.
Mm-hmm.
But these people are accusing me of that. They've never met me. They haven't walked into my studio. They haven't been pierced by me. Okay? You don't do that in a commercial environment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And like I said, when the average person who's accusing me of this is in their mid-20s or younger, they didn't live through the sexual revolution. They haven't had hundreds and hundreds of sexual partners. Which, from their standpoint, that's just like, oh my God, you're kidding me, you're lying. It didn't happen. Where I'm standing from is like, that's all I had. Most of my friends had thousands.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a different lifestyle. You know, I'm 37. I'm at the bottom rung of these. Most of my friends are 45, 50 years old, and they did it for a whole decade prior to me getting old enough to do it. And they had thousands of partners. It was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really common. But if you have enough sexual experience, you can look at someone and you can read their body language, and you know, literally, you know if you can walk up to them, stick your tongue down their throat, and your hands down their pants, and have them like it, right then and there.
But like you said, this is a different generation. These are, you know,
mm-hmm.
like you said, 16 to 25-year-old kids that just don't have that experience and don't know how to deal with this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so who knows, maybe it's not, I mean, if it may be appropriate in one environment, but not necessarily in this one. Either way, I didn't want to really get into this in the interview. It doesn't,
mm-hmm.
you know, who cares, right? Anyway, what I do want to talk to you a bit about after mm-hmm. this song is a bit about your aftercare, because you use, I don't know what the best word for it is, certainly a more organic aftercare than most sort of chemical-ridden people are
mm-hmm.
recommending. Anyway, we're going to continue on that Japanese mm-hmm. Japanese pop trend. This is Robo Shop Mania, Smile and Shine.
Wake up, 8 minutes now.
All right, Todd, tell me, someone gets a PA from you, what's the aftercare you recommend?
Depends on the gauge. What people don't realize, they hear about this large gauge stuff and this and that. The thicker you go, the more intense it is, because you are causing more tissue damage. So you really have to get your aftercare together. You can't just go, oh, do salt soaks. Oh, use saline. You know, you really have to know what you're doing. And the more tissue damage you cause, the more intensity it is, and you really have to have the next level of intense aftercare just right to make it heal, or you're going to have a problem, a really big problem. So depending upon the person's maturity level, what type of sexual response they want to achieve, what type of aftercare I think that they're willing to do, and I sit there and explain the differences between an 8 and a 6 and a 4 and a 2 gauge and what they're going to really have to do to heal it and so forth. And literally, a 2-gauge PA, I can heal those on someone who's healthy, who doesn't drink, who actually eats red meat and doesn't do drugs, in 2 weeks. Done. But it's a very intense 2 weeks. And somebody's got to be willing to deal with the intensity. They can't just get this and go back to work and pretend nothing happened.
So what do they do?
They've got a very intense minor surgery that they did.
So what do they do?
Say if we're doing a 2-gauge, this is a scalpel procedure. It's going to bleed.
Mm-hmm.
And I use 3 herbs for healing, which are antibiotic, anti-inflammatories, and one's a very good anti-bruising agent. And I also use another herb that will slow and finally stop the blood loss. It's not an instant you put it on. You have to soak it, and finally it'll stop the blood loss. So they're going to be sticking their dick in a cup of these herbs for a good hour or two as it finally stops the blood, depending on how healthy they are, how much stress they're under, how much sleep they've got. All this contributes when you're dealing with large gauge piercing, what you're going to be able to experience or not. They can expect to be sitting in the bathroom with this cup, with their dick in this cup, for at least an hour and up to 3 or 4 hours. And then it'll see for about 24 hours, which I'd rather sit with my dick in a cup than having a big baggie of blood the next day. It's much better. It'll seep for the next day or two, and if their dick gets really large upon erection, which some really swell, then they're going to have that nice big baggie of blood around their dick the next day if they get an evening erection
mm-hmm.
in the middle of the night. But
they have
showers. They have a special herb that they put on. So
let me interrupt here.
Mm-hmm.
The special herbs, can you say what they are, or is this Todd's magic formula that you don't want to give out?
Well, the main herbs are on the site. They're lavender, red clover, and arnica. Arnica is the anti-bruising agent. They're all anti-inflammatories, antibiotics.
All fairly well-known ones. Yeah, people can look them up on any number of sites if they want to learn more about them.
The other herb is an Aztec herb called Cuachalate. And this herb, if overused, is extremely dangerous, but it's extremely potent, which is why I don't have it on the site, because you can overuse it very easily.
What happens?
You can over-dry yourself.
Okay, it dries out the tissue if you use too much.
It can dry off the tissue and cause a major problem.
Same as using alcohol or... same drying effect.
It has a drying effect. It doesn't have the crystallization effect alcohol will, for lack of a better term. To give you an idea, let's say someone has a bleeding ulcer. Well, contemporary medical science says, well, we have to cut this out and refill your stomach lining. That's the only way we can heal it. Well, literally, Cuachalate will dry it up and cure it,
mm-hmm.
heal it. Cuachalate is strong enough to where, let's say you have a surgery burn, and just doing soaks with just this herb and peeling off the dead tissue as it dries daily, let's say you have a surgery burn on your hand, all you're going to have by the time you're done healing it is a slight discoloration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's that potent. But you have to know how to use the herb. You can really injure someone if you don't know what you're doing. And most people, they don't know. So that's why I didn't put it up on the site.
Where did you figure out how to use it?
My girl, Ophi, who I've been with for 8 years, her uncle was a renowned Mexican herbalist who people fly in from all over the world. And specifically, the mention I gave you of the hand burning, her aunt used that on her cousin, and that was the result when she was a little girl,
mm-hmm.
with just that herb.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met her, I had a little bit of a sub-incision. And the next time I did a cutting, then she mentioned that herb, and we brought it out and we tried it. And I tend to experiment around on my own body before I use it on other people, so I get the full feeling of what exactly I'm doing. And that's exactly how I learned how to use this herb, was on my penis.
It's definitely the best way to learn doing stuff on yourself.
Right. Yeah, I'm absolutely in amazement at people go, oh, I'm a piercer, and I've got two or three piercings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, no, you're someone who pretends to be a piercer who pokes holes in people and takes money, because they have no comprehension of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion of those people.
Well, I know a lot of my understanding of the way piercing works is just by having had tons of piercings and, you know, knowing how they've all healed differently and having treated them differently and, you know, seeing the different results.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the next thing I want to ask you about, Todd, this is probably something you've gotten an awful lot of online flack about, and, you know, when I've mentioned to people, you know, I'm interviewing Todd Bertrand, is there anything you want to ask him? Everyone has said, ask him about his autoclave. So tell me, Todd, what's up with your autoclave?
Well, I actually happen to have one.
but you don't always use it.
No. Piercers have this thing, thinking that they have medical training. They don't, usually. Anybody who truly has medical training knows that there are chemical sterilization processes. Anybody who has medical training has heard of what they call an endoscope. What an endoscope is a camera that they can use to put down your arteries to see whether they're clogged or not. An endoscope is not autoclavable. There is nothing more infectious or capable of being infected easier with more damaging results than your arteries or your heart. Period. End of story. But if they can put an endoscope and wave aside and use it just fine, but, oh my God, we can't put a piercing needle in it, they have no concept of what they're doing at all.
Mm-hmm.
They scare me that they're so ignorant of true medical terminology, medical science, to say this is a must, okay? The reason why they said it was a must is because the APP said it's a must, and the APP said it's a must because an autoclave at the time cost $4,500, and Gauntlet didn't want all these little piercing stores popping up doing piercings, and they thought they could control it like that.
Because you buy a jug of Wavicide for $40.
Bingo. And be sterile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Wavicide is perfectly sterile when used properly.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff's wonderful. When it doesn't work anymore, it turns color. You can see it's not going to work.
Yeah, no, it's true. I've used Wavicide as well. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that brings up the point that it is interesting that a lot of piercers, they don't really... They never really concentrate on understanding what they're doing. They piercing for them is sort of a rules based system, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, same with doctors. They go to medical school, they get their PhD, and all they know is about what they read.
Mm-hmm.
And piercers do the same thing, which is absolutely pathetic. There's no concept for any room of improvement, any experimentation, any true understanding of the process of what they're actually doing to someone, and here they're altering someone's life.
Well, I think it would be all right if you're a carpenter or something that's a very established field, you know, where we've done 10,000 years of research, but
right.
You know, piercing in the West is a new field, you know. I think people who are piercing need to be on their toes and need to really know what they're doing and need to always be learning, and I think a lot of them aren't.
I'd say 99.999% of them are not, or learn to a degree and they're done.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of the coin is there's two ways to make money in this business, okay? Put up with the fact you're not, or you get to a point where all you do is production piercing. You're in and out, you're gone, and it's good enough to create a hole in a ring and see you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can't do it that way, you're not going to make any money. There are people who make $100,000 a year or better in this business, but that's the only way they're doing it. They're in and out, smallest as possible, okay? We can't give them the next size up if we can get them the smallest one, because then we don't get that next size stretch,
mm-hmm.
okay? And if they're happy with your work, they're going to come back to you and get your jewelry. You get 70% back of everything you do, and it takes this $30 piercing. By the time they come back and they stretch, and every time they come back they get something else, or their buddy does, and in the course of a year it turns this $30 piercing into $2,000.
Sure, you're selling them a subscription instead of a single magazine.
Exactly. And that's what makes money. But unfortunately, as far as what the piercee is considered, what it could be, it's absolutely detrimental to the piercee.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's fine if they want a 14-gauge eyebrow, but if they want a really good sexual piercing, or if they want something really good, otherwise, I mean, a lot of people don't want a 14-gauge labret. They want an 8-gauge labret. But they go in and, oh, no, no, we have to start like this and stretch it out because it makes some money. That's all it's about.
Well, let me ask you, Todd, what's the difference? Say someone gets a 12-gauge PA and over a period of a year stretches it up to 2-gauge. How is that? How is the end result different?
It's quite a bit different.
All right.
Depending on how they healed it. Having had a 12-gauge PA and stretched it out myself, assuming they even get good placement, which most people start at 12 gauge, won't place them properly. Let's assume they get good placement. What happens is, because it's thinner, you're creating a much denser area of scar tissue. It's much harder to stretch. The denser area of scar tissue is much less sensitive. So they just desensitized their dick. Why did you get a piercing for sensation and do it in such a way that desensitizes the area you put it in? That's pretty stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what it does. You will lose anywhere from 30 to 100% of your sensation from starting small in that given area.
Well, I don't think that's true for everyone, though.
For 80% of the people.
Boy, I don't know if I'd agree with that number, but...
That's going based upon statistical average, based upon my 12 years of experience and what I've seen with who have I've pierced and who I've come in contact with.
Mm-hmm.
To give you an example, I didn't have sex with these two people. I took them at their word. I've talked to two girls who swear up and down that prior to getting their nipples pierced, at 14 gauge, they became breast orgasmic. Prior to getting their nipples pierced, they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? At 6 or 4 gauge, you're dealing in 80% or better are going to be able to have breast orgasms from those piercings done and healed properly at that size. But you're not going to get that when you pierce at a 14 gauge and stretch it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will tell you, I've got a few emails in the last month of girls writing me,
mm-hmm.
you know, asking whether it was normal for, their nipple piercings to eliminate feeling in their nipples. These are regular 14-gauge nipple piercings.
It's very, very common, especially over a couple of years.
You know,
the scar tissue continually builds up because they're continually expanding and contracting and cutting that. And I would say somewhere between 30 to 50% lose partial to complete sensation in a piercing done thinner than 8-gauge in the nipples.
Yeah, I think
conservatively.
I think we could argue about those percentages, but I'll say even if it's 1 in 50, that 1 in 50 is a solid argument for why not do it bigger.
In my opinion, even if it's 1 in 1,000, it's too much,
mm-hmm.
too many.
Mm-hmm. Because yeah, no, you're right. Even obviously a whole different set of play is available in an 8-gauge or larger piercing than in a,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, why? You know.
Even if you're into light, just mm-hmm. light play, mm-hmm. it's real easy to accidentally give that piercing a solid tug, and you can do damage.
Real easily. You know, look at it this way. If the girl doesn't like to have, or the guy, like to have a dull knife stuck inside them and get off that way, then why are they putting a dull knife in their nipple? Why are they putting a dull knife inside their penis or labia? Because that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thickness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Don't you want something that feels good like a finger? You got to go thicker then.
That's a good point. Do you want a dull knife or do you want a finger?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What feels good to your body?
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I want to take another break. Mm-hmm. When we come back, Todd, I want to talk about some of the heavier procedures that you advocate, that being female circumcision,
mm-hmm.
A number of other things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is Creature of Habit by Swearing at Motorists.
In south of the town where I know they'll be drinking, maybe I can stop thinking. Put your money away, this round is on me. I can see we all need it. And all your stories and lies don't mean a damn thing if you don't get home safely. One more for the road. Some takeout and go back to my house and listen to my roommate's record. You can sleep on the couch, so can you. Well, so be it. And if the phone rings at 8:32, well, you know that I'll answer.
All right, we're back. Todd, one of the let's start with female circumcision. Let me ask you first, what is that?
Female circumcision is one of several things. To circumcise literally means to remove around, but it doesn't say around what. That's the actual meaning of the word. In the female, it could be remove around the vulva, anything in the vulva area. You can remove partial or complete the hood, the inner labia, the outer labia if you wanted to. Generally, it means anything to do with the hood or the inner labia in most contexts. Some people will include the removal of the clitoris itself in that context, but that's incorrect. That's a clitoridectomy. Mm-hmm. The anti-female circumcision groups try to persuade the gullible that female circumcision is truly labial occlusion, which is actually really rare, but what labial occlusion is that they remove the inner labia of the hood, the external clitoris, and almost all of the outer labia, and sew up the remainder, leaving a very small menstrual and urinal opening.
Essentially a total genital amputation.
Essentially, yeah, external genital amputation. Well, and they try to call it female circumcision, and that's not true at all. Female circumcision, in its true sense, like I said, is partial or complete removal of the hood and or the inner labia, or any portion thereof.
And I think that, you know, people, especially in this scene, don't realize how incredibly common it is. Last week, about a month ago, Maclean's, mm-hmm. which is Canada's equivalent to Time magazine, had a cover article on female circumcision, mm-hmm. as done by plastic surgeons here on women in the West, and, mm-hmm. and spoke very positively about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cosmo has done the same, as have any number of other magazines. I mean, this isn't a far-out thing. I mean, a lot of people, even a lot of real legitimate doctors, have stood behind this.
There are very legitimate reasons to have it done. First off, why does a girl get a boob job or breast reduction, enhancement or reduction? Because they're not comfortable with how their body's shaped. They want to be shaped like this. They like it. Why shouldn't someone have power over how their genitals look or respond? We're under the illusion that because it's down there on a woman's body, it automatically feels good. Well, this is simply not true. Inner labia or hood can actually feel better than the clitoris, but they could also feel very bad to touch, or they could actually feel nothing at all. So if something's feeling bad to touch down there, or it doesn't feel a thing, why do you want it on your body? You don't, and you're better off to remove it. Or if you don't like the way it looks, it grosses you out. Everybody has a different shape of what they want to look like, and we as adults should have the right to choose that. In the United States, there are some places that do offer it as labioplasty. Most of them are not very good. Even plastic surgeons, they absolutely suck. They're horrible. They're very expensive, and most of them won't touch it for fear of medical malfeasance lawsuits. They are afraid they'll lose their medical license. It's a very, very touchy subject here in the U.S. It's really, really scary because then I've known girls to actually take matters in their own hands and cut it off with scissors and stuff like this and have tremendous problems from it. But done right, it can be a very, very enhancing procedure and can actually cause tremendous increase in sexual sensation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the footage that I've seen is a very bloody procedure. When you're talking about the deeper removals that are fairly complete,
mm-hmm.
is that a dangerous procedure?
Anytime you're dealing in loss of blood, you're dealing in potential shock, and when you're dealing in potential shock, you're dealing in potential death. What most people don't understand, while we're speaking of this boggles my mind. I do not know of personally any place I've ever been that does piercings, that does tattoos, that has a refrigerator with some orange juice and some cookies and some bananas on hand for when people have a blood sugar reaction. They didn't even ask them if they've eaten. They don't. It goes right over their head. And then people pass out on the floor and think, oh, gee, it was so painful. It had nothing to do with pain. They didn't eat, and they didn't take care of their self, and they think it's like going to get their hair cut, and they have a blood sugar reaction and pass out. It has nothing to do with pain. It has to do with blood sugar reaction. And if you, you could go into epileptic shock and seizure and death from this, and people just don't take care of business. It's really, really sad. But shock is very, very easy to prevent. It's a matter of having enough blood sugar in your system so when the brain reacts to this injury, it reaches for its food, which is blood sugar, so it can assimilate the new reactions that it's having. Oh, my God, somebody's cutting my pussy. Oh, my God, somebody's cutting my dick. Oh, my God, this is happening to me. And you don't go into shock. It's quite simple. Mm-hmm. You have to have blankets on hand. If you're doing something major, you really want to have an IV drip on hand, depending on what you're doing. But anybody does any type of body mod that doesn't have something as simple as orange juice and bananas on hand shouldn't be in the business. And mm-hmm. that's almost everybody out there.
Mm-hmm. Like we mentioned before, most piercers work in a pretty clinical and impersonal environment. If I remember some of the photos of the procedures that we're talking about here, mm-hmm. you know, there's a couple naked girls, there's a bed, there's some ropes. What sort of situation are these procedures done in?
They're done in a home studio, right in a bed.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference where it's a hospital bed or the bed in your house? It's a bed. The bed,
yeah.
A bed is a bed.
What I'm asking, too, is it a scene? Is it, I mean, what relationship is there? I mean, is it...
Most people come here because they don't want to be in a clinical environment where they're seeking, they have enough intelligence to realize, gee, there's more to piercings than what the average piercing store out there is offering. And they travel from all over the world for this different type of feature.
Yeah, it's true.
Thousands of dollars to get here for $100 piercing.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true.
Which has a lot to do with what everybody else is doing. If I'm getting all these people from all over the world spending thousands of dollars to come here to get a $100 piercing,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty pathetic on everybody else's end that they're so primitive. But good for me and bad for them, I guess. But piercings, as we mentioned to me, are sexual. Mm-hmm. Do I want to have sex in the doctor's office? Well, probably not. Unless you're really into the medical aspect and that turns you on, you're probably not going to get turned on by this real clinical thing. Most people want to have their piercings, in my experience, be a very intimate, memorable, and sexual experience to them. It has nothing to do with whether they're having sex with me. I'm just the mode of how they achieve this inner sexual experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I'm just the doctor of the moment that allows it to happen for them. And they'd much rather be in that type of environment. And I've been requested to do many types of SM scenes with piercings and that sort of thing, with rope and flogging and all that. And it's really not that uncommon. As we mentioned earlier, this is where piercings came from. The leather gay SM movement. This is where it came from. This is what it's all about.
Let me ask you, do you think it's healthier to do a piercing in that type of environment? Healthier on a psychological level?
Absolutely. Tremendously. It's tremendously freeing. It means you appreciate what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you are doing it for yourself, for your innermost being, not because my buddy got it and I thought it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to you.
Right.
It's real.
Right. All right, I'll ask you next about sub-incision. Sub-incision, I guess, is sort of certainly a male analogon to circumcision or splitting of the hood.
In some aspects, yeah.
Now, first, you did that on yourself, and we've all read the various experiences on BME and in the PFIQ article.
Mm-hmm.
When I've seen the footage that you've done, it doesn't look like they're marked. It's just a quick cut it, and they seem to turn out perfectly. What's the procedure like? Is it simple? Is it or is there more to it that I'm not seeing?
Well, it's simple for me, but if you have an 8-year-old who's a musical prodigy, she or he will sit down and go, well, it's really easy. Why can't you do it? It's simple for me, but that doesn't mean it's simple for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned on the answer page of BME, there's a line that goes down the body, separates everything. All you got to do is follow the line. It's either on center or off center, but it gives you a line.
So you don't have to draw a line because it's already there.
Bingo.
Good enough. I guess that's true. I want to ask you. You've had a couple funny procedures come to you. One of them is this strip circumcision. Tell me about what was that, and why did the guy want it done?
Well, he was very eroticized. It took me forever to get this guy to tell me this, but he was very eroticized by the concept of having a scar on his penis from his first sexual experience, because the girl was licking his newly circumcised penis as a teenager and orgasming from it. And that was he was almost 7 years old, and evidently this had stuck in his mind as the best or one of the best sexual experiences he had, and he wanted to recreate this by having the scar on his penis. And that was his whole concept, was literally scarification of the penis.
And
it was quite interesting, I thought.
Mm-hmm. And he was an older guy. And
he was almost 70 years old. He's like 67 years old when he came here.
Mm-hmm. And you've had, I don't know how much I even want to talk about her, because it'll just result in a slew of emails to both me and you.
Mm-hmm.
But some of your, this, I think that 70-year-old guy was, real, real solid and sane, but not all of your clients have been quite so easy to deal with.
No. I've had a few people be rather on the very definite end of insane, to where you wonder how they even were let out of the funny farm. And that particular person you're alluding to actually hasn't been the only one. That one just got very deep under my skin, shall we say. But I've come to the conclusion that there's a very significant amount of people, which the medical professional has only seen the very worst end of this, that are into modification of the body that aren't quite all there in their head, which is really scary to me, really sad. And I certainly got a Lulu for one of those.
Mm-hmm. Now, you got fairly deeply involved with at least this one. Do you think that sort of your eagerness to do these procedures, and maybe because of your own sexual excitement attached to them, sort of sometimes makes you miss some of the other person's problems, and maybe blinds you to a reason why maybe you shouldn't be working on them?
That is very close to the truth. Let me give an analogy in your own life. Let's go back to where you got your first computer and we were first getting into mods. And now today, you've got zillions of subscriptions. You're it as far as on the internet. If anybody wants to do anything with piercings, you're it.
Sure.
You are it, Shannon.
Yeah.
And have been it for a long time. But let's just say back then when you had this inkling of an idea, okay, someone spelled out, gee, if you do this for me, I can do that for you and make you do that tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You'd want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd believe their story if it sounded reasonable. And that's exactly what happened with this girl.
Mm-hmm.
She gave me a story I wanted to believe in that sounded reasonable to me. And because I'm open to other types of cultural things and other types of sexuality, I gave her the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't occur to me that someone would invent literally their entire life story, their friends, their family, everything in detail.
Yeah, I'm hoping that at least a few of the people who are listening to this know what we're talking about. Otherwise, this is just a big in-joke. So we won't get, I don't think we'll go into it anymore.
Right.
I'm going to play one more song. And when we come back, I want to talk to Todd about some of his new plans, which are, for some of you, will hopefully be very exciting. And maybe you can do some fun stuff with Todd. Anyway, this is Fred Lane. This just got re-released on CD. It's just absolute insanity. This is The Man with the Foldback Ears.
The man with the foldback ears. The man with the foldback ears. His ears fold back, his thumbs are long. He makes a fist and he sings this song. A man wants to smell like a man, to crumple a can in the palm of his hand. This is a man. Where does he live? Where does he live? The man with the foldback ears. In his car, in his car, with his clothes outside his skin. He clipped your toenails for a dime. He used to do it all the time. He'd snip them off and file them down. And then he'd ride back into town. The man with the foldback ears. The man with the foldback ears. He picks his nose and he takes a call. He jumps the curb and hits a dog.
Some crazy stuff we just listened to. Anyway, You know, there are porn stars with nipple piercings. There's porn stars with a hood piercing, but there's not really much of a pierced porn market. There's O'Pearl and that whole Creative Art Collective or something
coming in Germany out of, or Frankfurt.
Yes, somewhere in Europe. You know, but that's a very specific type of fetishy pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And Todd, you've invested a lot of money in a new sort of both business and personal venture. You want to tell us a bit about that, and maybe how some of the people listening, if they're so inclined, could get involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have had the idea for quite a few years now to start doing pierced pornos, which the pornography market, first off, they don't want their girls pierced that much. They'll put up with a couple of little things. And it takes, under normal techniques, years to obtain any type of amount of engage, and thousands of dollars, so most people don't have it. In fact, I was trying to do this earlier, and it finally dawned on me that the only way I'm going to be able to do this is to literally do the modifications free and bring girls out and let them live in my estate that I just bought. I just bought a 3-acre estate with a very, very large house and pool and whatnot, and we're going to be remodeling it, making it extremely large. But so I'm going to be bringing girls from all over the world at my expense to stay for 3 months at my estate with free mods, but they have to have sex with me and other girls and other guys on film.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be videoing this and hopefully marketing this, which it will take some time to get out. But I think that's the only way to really get really intense mods. I don't know of anybody else who can literally sit and do 20, 30, 40 pussy rings or dick rings at one sitting and heal them and fuckable in 3 weeks besides myself.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the techniques. And people, I tell them that, and they can't even believe I'm doing one 6-gauge ring in 3 weeks and healing it. But that's what I can do. And so if you're cute and you're female, or if you're a guy, let me know.
They can contact you through www.toddbertrang.com. There'll be a link, obviously, with this as well, so they can just click over onto it. And I guess what they should email you a picture of themselves and
Email me, tell me their interest. It's going to be extreme. I don't want one or two piercings. You mm-hmm. want a hood piercing? That's not enough.
This is a lifestyle change. You better be into it. And
yeah, you better be into it. You're going to walk away with 20 to 50 piercings or of circumcision, some radical stuff.
Mm-hmm. If you're into it, it'd be a lot of fun.
And if you're female, you'll be living on my estate for 3 months, and you better be ready to prove to me that you're not a nut like the one I got. Before, I don't need that again.
Yeah. All right. Well, Todd, I want to thank you for talking to us today.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you for bravely standing forward and saying, you know, what piercing is really about to you, and I think to an awful lot of other people. I hope the movie project goes well, and I wish you the best of luck on it, Todd. And thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks. I hope to be back again one day.
Excellent.
Next song is Public Bath. My best life.